This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 329 of the show where we talk aviation. If you'd like to follow along with us, just visit airplanegeeks.com/329 for the show notes. I'm Max Flight. With me is Rob Mark, aviation journalist from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening to everybody, and thank you for joining us again.
Also here is aviation historian David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog.
Now I know hell's going to freeze over. He didn't mention the weather. I don't know how to deal with that.
I know. He finally got it right, didn't he?
No, it's great to be here. Looking forward to tonight. We don't normally talk about taxis, yellow cabs, or otherwise. So looking forward to tonight.
That's right. We're going to have a great conversation tonight. But also joining us for that great conversation is Brian Coleman, our associate producer. Hi, Brian.
Good evening, everyone, and I get to apologize in advance for the show probably going really long tonight. There's just so much going on in the world of aviation, and we stuff the show plan full of events and news and stories and listener feedback and all, and it might be long tonight, but it's going to be a good one.
Yeah, well, either that or I can just keep cutting you out.
That'll work, too.
We've crossed that bridge.
All right. Well, hey, I think we better introduce our guest for this episode. It's William Herp. He's CEO and co-founder of Linear Air. Now, Bill holds an airline transport pilot certificate, is a single pilot type rated in the Eclipse 500 VLJ, also director of operations of Linear Air's Eclipse Charter Management Company, as well as CEO of Linear Air's Air Taxi Digital Marketplace. Bill, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks, Max. That sounds pretty impressive when you say it. Looking forward to chatting with you guys tonight.
Well, it gets even better because I see from your bio that you have a Bachelor's of Business Administration from the University of Notre Dame.
Go Irish.
But that's not the end of it. You also have an MBA from Harvard Business School. So my first question is, you have a pretty impressive commercial marketing experience, including co-founding an online marketing company that I guess now is owned by eBay. So what came first, the marketing man or the aviator?
Well, going way back, I think the aviator did. You know, I grew up during the Apollo years, and one of my uncles flew for Air America and built a Pitt Special in his garage. This is back in Kentucky. And so I've been an aviation enthusiast and have had the bug for a very long period of time. But, you know, trying to get through Notre Dame and start a career, go to Harvard Business School, you know, become an entrepreneur, which has really been my professional calling over the course of the last 25 years, took me away from that. But between jobs back in the mid-90s, I asked my wife if it was okay if I get a pilot's license, and she said, yep, I live under the extended left downwind for runway 29 at Hanscom Field right outside Boston, and became a pilot, and you know, haven't really looked back since then. You know, really kind of the key here in the last 10 years or so has been the intersection of technology and aviation, which has really kind of flipped all the switches for me.
Fantastic. This is going to be a great conversation. And, you know, interestingly enough, if you go all the way back to Airplane Geeks episode one, the sort of feature story was the Eclipse VLJ. And that was in 2008 when we had the first episode. So we've come a lot of years since then. Eclipse has changed quite a bit since then. And so it'll be interesting to talk with you about the Eclipse jet as an air taxi and just the air taxi segment of the industry in general. So we're all looking forward to that.
Likewise.
We're going to start off first with a discussion of some current aviation news, including Delta segmenting and branding the cabin. The NTSB announces some preliminary findings in the Phenom 100 crash that killed six. Then IATA has released some recommendations for aircraft tracking. That's something that everybody has been watching very carefully. Also, we have some news on the Airbus A380 and A350. And maybe if we have some time, nuts on a plane. Also coming up, David, what are we looking at for a history segment?
Well, believe it or not, it's that time of year again. It's the last episode before Christmas. So what do? It's the holiday episode. It's hard to believe there's only two episodes left for the 2014. I don't know where 2014 went. So.
I know. It just flew by. All right. Well, in this week's Australia desk, Stephen Grant are back, and they bring us some developments in that region. And also, sadly, announce the loss of a friend. We'll talk about that. Rob has an aviation minute. Brian has a little report on his Flying Tigers adventure. What was the event that you attended, Brian?
There was a photo exhibit at the Monterey Park Library on the Flying Tigers of World War II.
Also, we'll finish off with a little bit of a listener feedback. But first, we'll start with the aviation news. First item comes from Business Week. This is Delta's new seating arrangement somehow makes coach even worse. Well, Delta has a plan. Their plan is to segment the cabin into three economy sections and two premium cabins. And then they would distinguish these different segments by price and service. And apparently Delta's looking to bring this branding into the cabin starting on March 1st, 2015. Interesting concept, all these different choices. I think what Delta is looking to do is get away from selling based on pure price and try to generate some branding around these different offerings in the cabin. Bill, as a marketing guy with some marketing experience, branding, of course, is very important. Segmentation is something that's oftentimes important. Do you think that's the case here?
Well, you know, I was alternately impressed and appalled with the story in that I'm impressed with the idea of segmenting your customers so that you can better tailor your offer to what they want. I'm not sure that's necessarily the case here, though. I think it's, attempting to squeeze the last dollar of margin out of a flight, which in and of itself is not necessarily bad, but I don't think it really has the customer's best interests at heart. They're not trying to give them exactly what they want, per se. And I think, you know, when it sort of crosses the line into solely looking to manage revenue and margin, you know, then it's kind of questionable whether or not it's ultimately going to be attractive to a broad enough group of travelers for it to make sense as a strategy. That said, you know, I personally, when I fly these days, will pay a little bit extra to get the exit row seat. You know, I do appreciate that, although sometimes the people sitting next to me in the exit row seats probably shouldn't be there, but that's kind of a different story.
Yeah. Well, we see an article from Cranky Flyer. Brett posted some comments on this. Did you guys take a look at that? Did you see what Brett was having to say about this topic?
Yeah, kind of, where's the beef?
Yeah, exactly.
And isn't this just a lot of rebranding of TWA from years ago?
Yeah, it's kind of a name shell game in a way. I mean, business elite becomes something called Delta One. First class, well, that stays first class and gets new seat covers. What's been economy comfort becomes comfort plus. You get a little extra leg room, some new seat covers, drinks and snacks included. What was economy becomes main cabin, and that's, I guess, pretty much the same as before. And then basic economy stays basic economy. I think Brett points out, same as the main cabin, but this is where you could get the lowest possible fares. So, I don't know, it's sometimes too many choices are confusing to consumers.
I think that's the point.
Yeah, sometimes that is the point, Rob. You're right.
Well, think about it. When you go to the grocery store these days, I mean, and you want to buy cereal. I mean, I grant you, back in the old days when I was buying cereal as a kid, they delivered it with a horse-drawn carriage. But be that as it may, you know, now there are 75 different kinds of cereal. And what I think happens that marketers often lose track of is that the consumer's eyes glaze over when they have too many choices. I don't know that this isn't headed down the same road. I mean, cheap is great. I mean, if we want to have the cheapest price or the most comfortable seat or but all the names, no one is going to remember all these names. And you know, I don't think anybody cares.
Rob, I also think flying with corporate America here, when they say, okay, you have to fly from point A to point B, which class of service are you allowed to choose? Is it only going to be basic economy? And yeah, where do these other classes come in? And how does that affect a corporate travel policy?
You know, what struck me, guys, was the takeaway that was sort of kind of slipped in there, where the elite status members are losing some of the benefits that they had before. You know, gold can't reserve these seats ahead of time. Silver can't reserve them, you know, even further out. You know, so there are some things there where it looks like they're trying to, you know, rearrange some of the benefits they had for their frequent travelers and substitute in, you know, opportunities for people who don't have elite status to essentially buy those privileges.
Makes you want to take a taxi now, doesn't it?
Okay. Well put.
Yeah, Brian's jumping ahead. But before we get to that, next item, this was in AIN Online. NTSB releases preliminary information on Phenom crash. Now, Rob, this is your story, but this is about a Phenom 100, right? The one that crashed December 8th, I believe, in Maryland?
Correct. On approach, crashed about a mile away from the airport. NTSB... basically, in fact, our friend Robert Semwalt, our guest from, what, 2 or 3 weeks ago, was the lead investigator and sort of the spokesperson for the NTSB on this one. And they did what they have done a couple of times now, which is to start releasing preliminary data from the cockpit voice recorder very early on. And we had that really the next day. And what we know is that the airplane got really slow at the point where the pilot lost control. He should very well have been out of the clouds, and the weather was pretty good, and the airplane got incredibly slow, way below the ref speed, and the stall warning went off, and the stall warning kept yelling all the way to the ground. So it's going to be an interesting one to see exactly what was going on in the cockpit at the time, in that last 20 seconds, because especially in an airplane like the Phenom, which is kind of like the Eclipse size airplane, you push the throttles forward, it reacts pretty quickly for a light airplane. And it, unfortunately, it doesn't seem like anybody was quite home on this one. And unfortunately, it killed all three of the people on the airplane, and it also killed three people on the ground when the airplane struck a home. And so it really has everybody scratching their head on this one.
And I guess there were no voices from the cockpit recorded during this end of this flight, right? There was no comments from the pilot or anyone else that was picked up
on
the recorder.
Well, I actually asked that. I was talking to Robert today, and I asked him that specifically. And excuse me. I'm sorry. He said he couldn't comment on that. So that doesn't mean there was or there wasn't. Okay. It was just not something they were ready to talk about. But, of course, it was being flown single pilot. And the Phenom is one of those airplanes like the Eclipse, like the Citation Mustang, like some of the Cessna CJs that are legal to be flown with a single pilot. And there was a passenger in the right seat. We don't know what was going on in that last 30 seconds, but it's going to take some time to find out. And right now, it's just basically a loss of control.
Bill, when you talk about an airplane that can be flown single pilot, something in this class, does that mean that it's usually flown by a single pilot? Or you could have two pilots, and that happens frequently, but one pilot is allowable? What's the usual scenario?
In my experience, the number of pilots most frequently will vary based upon the type of operation. So Part 91 private operations frequently can be operated safely with, you know, a single pilot because there's more flexibility around the schedule. It's not on a schedule of a customer like a Part 135 operation. In our case, with our Eclipse jets, we operate with two pilots unless it's a ferry flight or an operation for an owner where, there's flexibility with weather and other sorts of things that create, you know, higher minimums for operation with single pilots. I don't have any Phenom 100 experience, but just from the class of aircraft, very light jets, I know from the Eclipse in particular, you know, the systems are very highly integrated. The autopilot is very capable. There's a significant amount of support to the pilot from the computerized systems helping manage abnormal and emergency situations if and when they occur. And, in this instance, it feels to me like, you know, it was just a loss of situational awareness, perhaps a level off in an approach without advancing the thrust levers, and the speed decayed because some chatting was, you know, who knows what ultimately will turn out to be.
Yeah.
The factors, but you know, it feels like a private operation. It was not a commercially, you know, operated flight. It was privately owned. I wonder. I know the owner of the aircraft was on board the airplane. I don't know if he was the pilot, but you know, it's just an unfortunate and very sad circumstance. But you know, I think it's really kind of the difference between a private operation and a commercial operation.
Okay, good. Moving on. This is from a Runway Girl Network. IATA submits aircraft tracking recommendations to ICAO. And what's happened here is the International Air Transport Association's Aircraft Tracking Task Force. Now, they've submitted their report to ICAO. And this of course, relates back to MH370 and kind of the outcry, the public maybe disbelief that an airliner could be lost and so far never found. So the industry hasn't stood still on that issue. And what we see here is it's the task force giving its report. It's kind of hard to tell, I think, exactly what the direction here is going to be. At least it is for me. I mean, the approach by IATA is that, they say in the short term, make use of what is already available in the airline fleets in areas of operation. So I guess that means, at least initially, no new hardware or systems. And then in the near term, look at the business case for upgrading equipment. In the medium term, monitor new technologies which become available. And then the fourth phase in parallel, work with manufacturers and other industry stakeholders and explore the possibility of making systems tamper-proof. So I don't know, how does this leave you guys feeling? Like there's some progress or what?
Not me, but then I guess I've been following this, and it seemed like what I have seen out of ICAO, I mean, please understand, I respect the international aviation body aviation arm of the United Nations. It seems like most of the releases I have seen about anything related to the Malaysian airplanes has been an awful lot of back padding first about what a wonderful job it's been that they've gotten together and come together and decided things. And then by the time I finish reading the releases, I am thinking a bit like what you said, exactly kind of like the Delta thing. What exactly have they done here? Because it's not always real clear, at least not to me.
And of course, the airlines are, well, I say of course, but as you might, let me put it this way, as you might expect, the airlines are reluctant to going down a path that would require them to make big investments in tracking hardware or systems. And I guess that's understandable. I mean, there's got to be some kind of a limit to how much you want to spend to avoid a situation like we had with MH370. I don't know what that limit is, though.
Well, we don't even know what happened to 370. I think that's one of the reasons the airlines are reluctant. I mean, we've got a commercial operator on the line here. I mean, Bill, imagine if someone, one of your airplanes I realize this is a horrible thing to use as an example, I guess, but let's just imagine one of your airplanes disappeared and you never found out what happened to it, and the industry or regulators suddenly started telling everybody about what they needed in order to prevent another example of that, and you still have no idea what the problem even was. So how in God's name could you possibly say that any action would absolutely prevent the situation, other than perhaps the ability to tamper with the equipment?
Yeah, and you know, that's where I kind of came down. You know, like you said, you know, it's difficult to contemplate, and you'd hope that you never have to be in that situation. But you know, a circumstance like that where it appeared that the transponder was turned off. You know, having the ability for the transponder to continue to, you know, operate or just have it sort of be non-switchable, you know, seems to make some sense. But, you know, it's an unfortunate fact when, you know, when a situation like this occurs where there's not a lot of hard data about what actually happened, that the regulators, you know, jump in and start trying to regulate. So it's the industry in which we operate. And, you know, at the end of the day, anything that can help improve, you know, the ability of our company to monitor what's happening with our flights and make sure that they're being operated safely and that we know where they are at all times, I mean, I'd have to be supportive of that.
Well, I think these guys are under a lot of pressure to do something, right? Just
right.
Because of the, you know, the press and the public. And I can understand that, I think, because it's kind of hard for people to understand how, you know, this sort of thing could happen in this day and age. If you understand how this works, it's really not that surprising. I mean, the planet is large, an airplane is small, and a lot of things could happen.
And most people don't understand the complications involved with storing that data, where you're keeping it, right? They're equating it to getting in their car, turning in the GPS, and away they go. It's on a completely different scale, and I think that's one of the major issues. It's hard to explain to the general public why this is not easily done,
right,
or not done quickly, or, you know, without some forethought.
Right.
And the cost effectiveness of it as well. And this could be a huge financial burden for airlines for incidents that really don't happen all that often.
Well, we'll continue to follow this for sure. And I'm sure this will have some twists and turns in the coming months and probably years. On the other hand, who knows? Maybe this is one of those things that kind of, you know, fades as people's memory starts to fade as well. I kind of doubt it, but I guess that's an option as well. All right, we have a couple of items on Airbus from Bloomberg via Yahoo Finance. Airbus faces investment conundrum as A380 orders vanish. And also from the International Business Times, Qatar Airways refusal of first Airbus A350 looks bad, but no cause for concern, expert says.
Yeah, Max, based on the stories last week where we kind of, where I felt as though we beat up on Boeing, I contributed both of these to give Airbus
out, huh?
their fair share. Exactly.
All right. Well, the A380, now that's an interesting aircraft, you know, very large, obviously. The orders have been relatively low in number, kind of as you would expect. But more recently, Airbus has not been adding new buyers for the A380. Brian, they kind of have a choice right now. They can spend some money to develop derivatives that maybe would include things like more modern, more fuel efficient engines or something of that sort. Or they can just leave it as it is and let it play out as it will. Yeah, this is never going to be a high-volume kind of an aircraft.
Not as much as I'd like it to be. Yeah, I think passengers would much rather have frequency over having 500 to 800 people go from point A to point B.
Now, Airbus says that they still plan to break even on the program on a recurring cost basis next year, which is an interesting data point. But this thing costs about $25 billion estimated to develop, and breaking even on that when you throw in the development costs, is tough, and I don't know if that will ever happen.
Yeah, and is that including the subsidies along the way as well or not? And there's always been the big argument with Boeing and Airbus over who gets subsidized and how much and by whom and all that. But it just seems like this aircraft is never going to turn a profit.
Yeah, that's I think that's most likely. You know, we say it all the time, but in the aviation industry, you know, you make these big decisions and you essentially kind of bet your company. You can do really well, like decide to build the 737. Or you can, make a different kind of a choice, in this case, the A380, which maybe not play out so well. On the A350, Airbus launch customer Qatar Airways, they were to have taken delivery of their first aircraft, but the airline said that, nope, not ready, didn't provide a lot of details as to why. Jason Rabinowitz actually is quoted in this article saying that this probably doesn't represent something that's a problem. Qatar has a history of delaying, I won't say refusing, but maybe that's what it is, but delaying acceptance of new aircraft until it's just right. And that's probably what they're doing here.
Yeah, it's the first one. It's a complex aircraft. It takes a while to get things right. And that fit and finish, it could be something that simple. But it's certainly, a setback for the program.
Yeah, and it doesn't look good in the press. Some of the more recent articles indicate that maybe the acceptance is now scheduled for December 22nd. So if that's what happens, you're really only talking about a few weeks, and that's really not a big surprise for a customer that wants everything to be perfect the first time and, you know, wants to make the point that that's what their expectations are. Well, speaking about getting something perfect, last item, this is from Yahoo News. Apparently, sales of macadamia nuts are soaring in Korea, and the reason has to do with the daughter of Korean Air's chairman, who is also an executive in the company in charge of cabin service. But she didn't like the way a flight attendant was presenting her with the nuts as they were served. She apparently got agitated over that, demanded that the plane return to the gate so they could throw the flight attendant off the plane. And this has caused quite a stir, well, internationally, but also in Korea. A lot of folks have publicly apologized. She's no longer holding the position she held before. It's kind of a screwy story.
Is it screwy or is it just plain nuts?
I was going to say that.
I heard they made her a flight attendant, but I might be wrong.
That would serve her right. Well, business in Korea is interesting. Korean Airlines is kind of a family-owned business. Even though they don't own a majority of stock, sort of the business culture in Korea is for sort of family-controlled businesses. And the chairman, you know, puts his children in charge of, you know, all kinds of things as executives. And I don't know how well qualified they are in all cases. But this is another example of, you know, an incident that probably really shouldn't have happened. It's sort of spinning out of control and making for some good headlines.
Well, and I'm intrigued to see if they actually broke any laws in having to return to the gate for nuts.
Yeah,
that seems to be the news story now, which is, you know, where do they draw the line? And with the captain returning to the gate, he's saying, it's the chairman's daughter. Of course I'm going to return to the gate. How could I possibly disobey her? And if this happened at 35,000 feet and she demanded the plane turn around, again, this, it's just a crazy situation to me, and nepotism at its finest.
Oh, when the chairman apologized for not having raised his daughter well enough, it made me feel better about my own parenting, I can tell you that.
Yeah, very good. But again, we're speaking with Bill Herp. Bill, tell us about the air taxi business. I mean, this is something that when the very light jet concept was first emerging, we had visions of, I guess the term that was used back there, the terms was that the skies darkened by air taxis flying this way and that way.
But that's right.
Tell us about what does an air taxi mean these days as a practical matter?
The term has been somewhat co-opted from, you know, the FAA regulatory term. Some of your listeners may know that air taxi from a regulatory perspective is simply small charter airplanes that get a Part 298 exemption from the DOT's economic fitness rules. And that is really what an air taxi is. And we've co-opted the term over the course of the last, whatever it's been now, 10, 15 years, to define really a new class of capability that sort of seeks to span the distance between regional airline service and traditional jet or turboprop charter service using technically advanced small airplanes. Now, the Eclipse, of course, was the progenitor of a class of small jets that ultimately came to be called very light jets, weighing less than 10,000 pounds. Vern Rayburn, who came from Microsoft and Symantec and Lotus technology companies, sought to create this new class of airplanes by marrying his passion for aviation with his deep experience set in computer technology, essentially making Eclipse a flying computer. I believe that was his line. And seeking to create a high volume scenario based upon manufacturing techniques borrowed from shipbuilding and automobile production in order to drive the costs down and negotiate deals with the traditional aviation supply chain based on volume that would bring those prices down, that would allow us to create a jet option for folks who could afford a little bit more than full coach or business class travel for regional trips, but really couldn't justify traditional jet charter. Of course, the Eclipse business kind of became, a victim of the 2008 financial crisis. Eclipse went bankrupt, and several of the companies that were alongside us seeking to create a very light jet business, darkening the skies. I always think of the flying monkeys from The Wizard of Oz, but
yes,
we never quite got to that. But, we continued to fly the Eclipse, which is now back flying with new ownership, but more as a traditional manufacturer seeking to produce, 50 airplanes a year and with commensurately higher unit costs. So it has still a nice niche between turboprops and light jets in the charter market, but it's small. So these days, in the last year, we've turned our attention to supporting, the concept of having an aircraft platform, an option that bridges the gap between regional airline service and charter. But we've turned our attention to small, technically advanced piston-driven airplanes, which do have the economic profile to really make them a viable alternative to the airlines for regional air travel.
So what are some examples of a piston aircraft?
So every general aviation airplane rolling off every assembly line these days is technically advanced. They all have glass cockpits. There's no more steam gauges other than backup gauges. And that's, Piper, Cessna, Beechcraft, Mooney, and, of course, Cirrus, which has kind of led the way over the course of the last almost 15 years now. They're the largest manufacturer of single-engine piston-driven airplanes in the world. They've produced over 5,000 of the SR series airplanes. All of them are equipped with a whole airframe parachute, which makes them unique and gives them a different position in the marketplace in terms of the perception of safety. They're, of course, all technically advanced with PFD, MFD, glass cockpit technology, terrain, traffic, weather, XM, flight and known icing, creature comforts like standard air conditioning and so on and so forth. And we found that these airplanes, once people become aware of them as an option, it blows them away. And, to be able to do a day trip with a couple of fellows, be it for personal reasons or business reasons, and get it done for less than $2,000 total, also blows them away. So we've seen that once people become aware of these airplanes as options, that they're very eager to take advantage of it.
So where we've been sort of thinking more narrowly about what kinds of aircraft are suitable as air taxi, you're saying that we really should think more broadly and that many aircraft could be suitable.
Yeah, well, these days, and I say based upon current FAA data, there are about 1,000 companies in the United States that are FAA-certified charter operators that fly single and twin-engine piston airplanes that have the economics that would, you know, allow that trip that I just described, you know, a day trip, 300 miles with a couple of folks on board the airplane, and could be done for less than $2,000 total. And those 1,000 operators have between them about 2,000 aircraft, which if you apply some sort of simple math to it, means that it's a maybe a $500 million market segment as it stands today. And that's with each of those airplanes only flying a couple of times a week, which is typical of the operators that we've started working with. And our goal is basically to give them a couple of more trips a week and turn that $500 million market into a $1 billion market.
So this is less about, for Linear Air, this is less about a fleet that you own and more about utilizing the national fleet that exists?
That's right. Well, we still have our Eclipse Jet operation, three aircraft based in Hanscom outside Boston and White Plains outside New York. And, you know, we still do a tidy business with that. But our focus going forward is to expand our capabilities from a technology and consumer database management perspective, and really reach out to those 1,000 operators and hopefully bring more operators to the mix once the demand is there. We actually engaged a research firm, the transportation research firm that specializes in this sort of analysis, and they came up with a total annual number of about 25 million passenger trips per year could be good air taxi trips, representing almost $17 billion of market demand.
Hmm. Well, sticking with the demand side for a minute, what are the typical flyers like in this segment? What are these, just the fat cats that, you know, are out to have a good time and spend their excess cash? I know that's not the case, but
well, some. But if you're too fat, you're not going to be able to get on a Cirrus. So
yeah, I guess.
So there is some limiting factors there. You got to climb up on it. There are weight and balance. People have to wear headsets. So there's some sort of natural selection criteria that that keeps the market
trim.
Well, for now, anyway, you know, focused. But a typical scenario would be a day trip. You know, I'll give you an example of a trip that we did recently. White Plains, which is right outside New York City. Max, you must know where that is.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's a sort of a, you know, very successful, you know, regional airport around the New York metropolitan area right on the Connecticut border. And there was a group of folks that needed to get out to Ithaca, which is where Cornell and Ithaca College are. It's probably a 4.5 hour drive, maybe 5 hour drive, depending upon the bridges and so forth. And it was about an hour and 15 minute flight in a Cirrus. We were able to take them out at 9 a.m, let them spend the whole day there to get all of their business done, and bring them back in the evening, get them home in time for dinner. Their alternative to driving would have been to fly US Air. US Air flies from White Plains to Ithaca via Philadelphia. The fare for that trip on U.S. Airways was about $550 per person, because it's not a high volume trip where they're able to, you know, really bring the prices down. So, you know, the airlines are being successful at yield management, revenue management, and so the price was $550 per person. You know, to do that with a Cirrus air taxi with one of our operators in our marketplace was about $600 per person. So it was sort of a no-brainer for those folks to choose this method to get out there and get back.
So when the airplane's sitting on the ground, is it like a taxi, a traditional land-based taxi, and the meter's still running? Or how do you do that pricing?
Well, right now, you know, given the relatively low volumes, the pricing model is sort of traditional charter. And so what that means is that there's an hourly rate for the airplane. So, you know, if you charter a Gulfstream, which you guys may do from time to time, you know, the hourly rate is, gosh, I don't know, $10,000 an hour or something like that. It can be pretty high, right? The average jet charter is probably about $4,000 per hour. The Cirrus is about $700 per hour. Now, when you've got differences in speed and so on and so forth, but that $700 per hour is applied to the flight time. So White Plains, Ithaca, you know, call it 2.5, 3 hours, something like that, which is how you get to that $2,000 number. Depending upon the operator, we do sometimes charge wait time for the pilots, and depends upon the length of the time there. If you stay overnight, there's an overnight fee. There are other sorts of fees and services for services provided. But the basic model is the flight time times an hourly rate.
I have a question for you, Bill. I mean, over the years, of course, when people have been flying in regional airplanes until perhaps the last 7-8 years, people did not like turboprop airplanes. They did not like propeller airplanes at all. And, of course, I'm just curious how people have reacted to a single-engine airplane, especially if they end up going in the clouds. I don't know. I'm just curious if they've had any reactions or if they go, no big deal.
Yeah, you know, obviously something that we're very sensitive to. And, in fact, when we started Linear Air in 2004, while we were waiting for our first Eclipse jets, we flew Cessna Caravan turboprops. And again, we had the single engine issue. But and I think it was even more pronounced with the Caravan than it is with the Cirrus. And I'll tell you why. It's because typically the passenger is sitting up front and they always have a headset on. So they feel very connected to what's happening. They can talk to the pilot. They can see what's happening. There are the two big screens there. They can see the rain. They can see the weather. They really feel like, not necessarily that they're in control, but that they're not sort of totally in the dark as to what's happening. And I think that has a huge impact on sort of, you know, the comfort level of the customers.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Of course, that's why they built the Cirrus the way that they did. Was to try to at least offer whoever was in the right front seat that sense of understanding what was going on. And it seems like over the years, because I instruct in a Cirrus, and I have felt that with many people. They go, wow, I really like this. This is not like a little single-engine airplane. And, of course, you don't have the heart to tell them it is, but it's all perception, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I think a lot of it is the avionics, which I think extends to other aircraft types, given that they're all coming out with glass cockpits these days. There's just so much situational awareness, to use a pilot-y term, and that extends to the passengers as well. You know, turboprops, you know, had a bad rap because of all the vibration and the noise. And, you know, if you're seated next to where the props are, if you ever flew in ice, big chunks of ice hitting the cabin. I had that experience one time. And, you know, flying in the clouds and bouncing around. But, you know, the Cirrus and the other small aircraft that our partners do operate, you know, because of all of the situational awareness tools that the pilots have, it's a relatively simple matter these days compared to even, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, to navigate around weather, to stay out of the clouds, to stay out of the bumps. And to make it a really comfortable flight. And the autopilots, you know, the digital autopilot in the Garmin Perspective Cirrus, you know, it's rock solid. It's, you know, it's really fantastic in terms of its ability to control the airplane and create a nice smooth ride.
Yeah, and Rob, I think spending a lot of time in commercial aircraft, I think it would be really cool spending time in something like Cirrus and just having a very different flight experience for, again, ending up at point B from point A and just being that close and being able to look out the front window instead of a side window. I'd gladly give that up compared to flying a regional turboprop.
Well, one thing that I've always been amazed at is the number of times that I've carried people around that were not that familiar with the airplane. And you don't have to have much of a conversation starter to get people interested in what's going on. And they see, you know, because, of course, for people that have not seen a glass cockpit, I mean, there's a lot of color. There's a lot of movement. The screens are large. And it's very difficult at some almost anywhere to not say, ooh, what is that thing? And what does that mean, or what's that doing? And before you know it, half the flight is over, and people are just really jazzed about what they're doing. And that's one thing that I think, as Bill mentioned, I can't remember a worse experience in my life than being in about row 8 on a Caravan and feeling like, well, if something happens, it's all over because I'll never get to the front of the airplane. But I also, because I had no idea what was going on other than being able to look out the windows.
Yeah, and you know, the in the flights that I've done like that, you know, I always give people the option. I said, you know, here's the XM radio controller. You have a stereo headset that's noise cancellation. You know, if you'd like, you can listen to the news, listen to music, listen to sports. And 9 times out of 10, people say, no, I'm good. I want to listen to air traffic control. I want to see what's going on. So, you know, they really do enjoy that. And after every trip, and we've done thousands of trips at this point, but after every trip, our system sends out an email to the traveler and says, and I'm sure you've received emails like this, on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely would you be, based upon your most recent experience, to recommend us to a friend or colleague? That's called the ultimate question. Some guys from HBS figured out that's a quantitative way to measure customer satisfaction. And all we ever get are 9s and 10s. And, of course, there's the experience of the flight, but then there's everything that's kind of wrapped around it. You know, you don't have to go to the main hub airport and fight the traffic and park, you know, a mile away and get on a bus and then go and queue up and go, you know, wait in line to get your ticket and then wait in line to go through security and then wait in line to get on the plane and hope that there's room for your carry-on bag when you do get on the plane and then be told that there's a mechanical and yada, yada, yada. You know, you come to a satellite airport, business aviation airport, you go through one of the FBOs, the fixed base operators, the pilot greets you, you know, you've got a personalized experience. Many places they'll valet your car. You know, you walk right out to the airplane, you climb in, you get personal treatment, and away you go. Same thing at the other end. You know, it's interesting. One of the most common questions our customer service people get is, well, what happens when I get to my destination? Can I rent a car? Can I, you know, how do I get? And, you know, I'm always tempted to say, well, it wouldn't be much good to have an airport if the only thing you could do when you got there is stay at the airport.
Yeah.
So, you know, but the whole experience is so, you know, eye-opening for many people. They just don't, they don't get that. You know, there's something like, gosh, I don't know, what is it, 300 airports in the United States that have commercial airline operations, and there's like 5,000, you know, public use airports in the United States that are available for air taxi operations. And then, of course, you know, the service that we're able to provide, people find us by searching on Kayak. We're on Kayak, we're on HipMunk, internet travel search sites, a variety of other ways. They end up coming to our site. They can do an automated booking, quote, and booking process. And, of course, customer service available to help them out with any questions they have, like, can I get a car at my other, at the other end?
Bill, you just started to go in the direction where I was thinking, particularly with respect to Kayak and HipMunk. And what I was going to ask you was, what are the, some of the things that you're doing to help make people aware of what this kind of a service can offer and how it may be of value to them?
Yeah, well, we are gearing up for a big 2015 in terms of awareness generation. So I expect that your listeners will be hearing a lot more about us as we roll into the new year. But the investments that we've made to date, which really go back to the beginning of 2013, about 2 years now, have been to connect our online booking system to internet travel search, Kayak and HipMunk, so that people who are searching for white planes to Ithaca will find Linear Air as an option. And we've got a half a dozen operators now in our network, Boston, two in the Boston area, one in Hartford, two in the New York area, one in Philly, and two in the D.C. area. And then we've just signed up a guy in South Florida, and we have a guy in Silicon Valley out in the West Coast as well. So I guess that's 7 or 8. The numbers are growing every day. You know, we promote it as Linear Air, and it's operated by whichever operator is appropriate for the results that we're presenting on Kayak. You know, so what we focused on so far has not really been awareness generating. It's been creating the technical connections to allow people to find us. I'm proud to say we've still done, you know, close to 500 flights this year with really people kind of stumbling across us. But that's led us to the point at which we're able to raise additional capital to say, okay, this now can be rolled out. So 2015 will be focusing on awareness. So we'll be doing, you know, more promotional events. We'll be doing, we've had success with programs with destinations, hotels, resorts, ground transportation providers. We've got a a program in the works with the leading $40 billion market cap ground transportation provider that'll be rolling out for the New York City market in the next few weeks. So those sorts of things, just to get the word out, because what we found is that once people find us and they try us, then they repeat purchase at a very high rate. In fact, our customers who came into the company this year bought an average of 8 trips
wow.
during the course of this year. Yeah,
that's
they
amazing.
Repeat purchasing. Yeah, and then our cohort from 2013, all of them bought an average of 4 trips this year. So it's once people try it, they don't want to do anything else. Mm.
What's your criteria for the operators that you select to partner with you?
Yeah, so far, because we've wanted to kind of, you know, focus our attention and sort of streamline the process of describing what air taxi is, we've worked with only Cirrus operators, although we expect to expand that as we roll into 2015 as well. Obviously, all Part 135 approved operators that have surveillance and monitoring by the FAA, that are meeting the commercial standards for pilot experience and training, that are meeting the FAA commercial standards for aircraft maintenance and so forth, insurance requirements, and then service level requirements. We have a contract that requires our operators to, for example, be in position 45 minutes prior to departure, to have the aircraft cleaned on a periodic basis. Those sorts of things that are more sort of service oriented as opposed to regulatory. But the basic 135 standards are fairly high in terms of the requirements that operators have to get past in order to receive that certificate.
And what do you need in terms of pilots, Bill? I mean, what kind of requirements do they have to have?
Yeah. So again, the Part 135 standards create a relatively high baseline with single engine land aircraft like the Cirrus and the others. The operators, pilots have to have a commercial pilot certificate. But because they have to obviously be able to operate passenger carrying operations in instrument conditions, they have to have a minimum of 1,200 hours. The regs require you to have 1,200 hours to be PIC under Part 135, carrying passengers in instrument conditions. And then in the jet, everyone has to have an ATP to be PIC because that's what the regs require. So you have to have a minimum of 1,500 hours. But with turbine operations, we typically have a minimum of 2,500 hours with a minimum of 500 hours multi-engine.
So, Rob, do you qualify?
If I was looking for a job, God, I would hope so. I mean, heavens, but they don't want guys my age. When you fly the Eclipse, do you fly it single pilot or with two pilots?
We fly two pilots with the Eclipse, although we do have a single pilot op spec. That does allow us to fly Part 135, but we don't use it. We have it available to us for owner flights and things like that to provide belt and suspenders in case there's ever any question about what part a particular flight's being operated under.
Mm-hmm. And then what about the person in the right seat of the Eclipse? Are they at ATP standard as well, or do they not require as much time?
Under Part 135, the FOs, the SICs, only have to have a commercial certificate. So commercial multi-engine instrument, and then we give them an Eclipse SIC type rating. So they have to have that in order to comply with the ICAO standards in order to fly internationally. And here in the Northeast, we do a lot of trips to Canada. So all of our SICs have SIC type ratings. And then, of course, we have a two-pilot training program that's approved by the FAA. And in fact, we have a contract with the FAA to train all of their inspectors in the Eclipse because of our experience set. So we do in-airplane training, both initial and recurrent training for FAA inspectors for the FAA under that contract. So the folks that come in to the right seat, we expect them to transition relatively quickly. So everyone that we hire meets the minimum standards to be an ATP. And typically what happens is that after 100, 150 hours in the right seat, then we give them an upgrade to the left seat and we give them an ATP type ride, ATP check ride along with their Eclipse 500 type ride.
And how are you liking the Eclipse? Maybe in particular those Pratt & Whitney Canada engines.
Yeah, well, those are the remarkable, you know, little miracles that enabled the whole class, right? The Pratt 600 is on the Eclipse, it's on the Mustang, it's on the Phenom, and you know, the heck of it is that, you know, I say the heck of it because, you know, Eclipse got caught up in the global financial crisis, and they made a few, you know, as it with hindsight being 2020, not the wisest business decisions about how to run their business. And as a result, the original business went bankrupt. And the heck of it is that the airplane is a terrific little airplane. It does what it was designed to do. It meets all the criteria. You know, at up in the 30s where we typically will cruise, we see fuel burns that are less than 400 pounds total. You know, that's less than 60 gallons total, which is, you know, in jet terms, ridiculously little fuel. So it's a very fuel-efficient airplane. It's a very fast airplane. It cruises at Mach 0.64, 375 knots. So it makes it faster than a Citation. It's faster than a Mustang. I think it's about the same speed as a Phenom 100, but it's burning, you know, quite a bit less fuel than a Phenom 100, maybe 70% less fuel and maybe 50% less fuel than a Mustang. So it's terrific. And, you know, the passenger comfort is not bad. Typically, it will have two passengers is sort of our average load. And the way the fuselage is designed, it's sort of egg-shaped. So the widest part of the cabin is where the passengers sit. So they have a fairly large amount of shoulder room. And the you know, the seats are more than first-class pitch. And they've got a front-row seat to, you know, all of what's going on in the cockpit.
Fantastic. Well, Bill, we need to start to bring this to a close. Tell our listeners where they can find out more about Linear Air or any other air taxi or related resources that you can think of.
Sure. Well, the best place to start is at www.linearair.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Linear Air. You can, of course, find us on Kayak and Hipmunk as well if you're searching for travel.
And the name. Tell us about the genesis of the name.
Linear Air?
Yes.
Well, you know, the shortest distance between two points, right, is a straight line. And, of course, it's also a play on airline, Linear Air. And the URL was available.
Yeah, that's always important. That's sometimes that's what drives the name in the end. Can you get URL? All right. Well, Bill Herp, want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been a fascinating conversation. I hope you had as much fun as we did.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. Thanks very much.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. First of all, let me say there's a lot of people with positive feedback about the movies, so try to get that concreted and nailed down over the next couple of weeks on what the first movie will be. I'll let everybody know in advance so they'll have a chance to go out to Netflix and get it. So it's always been my tradition to do a Christmas story or a carol for the last episode before Christmas. This year is just not coming. I found an aircraft to do for a history segment called the Christmas Bullet. Doesn't really fit with the theme, not to mention its wings ripped off on takeoff on its first flight. Then I checked the Wiki Aviation Portal and found out for December 25th, 1997, quote, children in North and South America received their toys late when due to an inoperative APU and an ingrown hoof nail on Blitzen, Santa Claus's sleigh registered N-O-E-L loses its eavesdrop status. The glitch forces the sleigh to take more northerly route over the Atlantic and make additional tech stops in Shannon, Ireland, and Keflavik, Iceland. It's got to be true. It was on Wikipedia. Sometimes you just can't top something from the past, so this year I'm not going to try. I hope the 2015 brings you happiness, prosperity, health, and all your airplane geek dreams come true. To quote Robbie Fowler, if you pray enough for things, I'm proof that they can happen. I feel like a kid on Christmas Day now that every day, it's something I've wanted for a long time, and I'm happy as anyone to be here. It's great to be back at my first love. Well, it's always great to our listeners for taking 90 minutes of their lives every week for us. So, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and we'll see you in 2015. So this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Thank you, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 14th of December, 2014. And gee, Steve, I don't know. It's been a while. Did I do that right?
Oh, you sounded pretty good, but it hasn't been that long, man. It's only been a few weeks.
Oh, it feels like it's been much longer than that.
Well, it has for you.
Yeah, well, there is that.
Well, let's have a go. I've only been doing this for 5 years. We should get it right. Welcome, folks, to the Australia Desk for episode 329. Well, Grant, what should we do? I know. Let's do something different. Let's talk about Qantas.
No, come on.
They've been back in the news this week.
Yeah. But there's, okay.
They're firing people at the top. Well, sort of. Well, people are firing themselves at the top. What's going on?
I don't know. There seems to be a bit of an exodus. It's not really an exodus. It's just two of the senior positions. We've got Simon Hickey, the chief executive of Qantas' loss-making international operations, and Lyle Strombe, the boss of domestic, which is one of the powerhouses, are both going to leave the airline by February. This is a bit of a shake-up.
Yeah, and interesting. Lyle Strombe now, there's been a lot of talk. He's been in the sights of a lot of people, particularly from their unions over recent years. You might hear in some of the commentary around the place, apart from Helen Joyce, who's a very common and well-known name, but Lyle Strombe gets mentioned a lot too. He also came from Ansett, the same place that Helen Joyce came from. And for those of you who need a bit of a history lesson, well, Ansett didn't do so well. In fact, September 11, 2001 was infamous for more than one thing. I can tell you that was about the time that Ansett Airlines died as well, by sheer coincidence. And Strombe and Helen Joyce were right at the top of that management team at that time, if memory serves.
Well, funny you should mention that, because Strombe was the person who hired Joyce into Ansett in the 90s. And then once Joyce was over in Qantas, he actually hired Strombe back into Qantas from Virgin Atlantic. So, yeah, kind of interesting, especially as Strombe was being seen as a successor to Mr. Joyce, perhaps, potentially.
Yeah, I wonder where he's going. You know what, Grant? He might just follow the way most other Qantas executives go and end up at Virgin Australia. It seems to be where they all go.
Yeah, well, a few of them do wind up over there. Maybe it's the difference between, I don't know, maybe things are sort of established and on track and they need a different kind of personality to run it. I don't know. Everyone's being pretty tight-lipped about what's going on in there. There's not really been a lot said about why these people are out, at least not in the general press that we're seeing. None of the media are really saying what the inside goss is.
One thing that was always quite often in the news in business circles is the amount of remuneration for senior executives of, most companies. And, you know, Alan Joyce's his salary has certainly been talked about a lot over the years. I was just doing a bit of research here, and according to this article here in businessweek.com, they're saying here that Lyle Strombe's package is worth about $1.669 million Australian dollars. So if he's going somewhere else, I'd say in the business world, a man with his experience, he's been around the game a long, long time, since the late 80s, in fact. Everybody has their price, Grant. I wonder if he's going chasing the dollars.
Yeah, he could well be, mate. He could well be. But speaking of chasing dollars, I think his replacement's going to be someone kind of interesting for you.
Yes, I read with great horror, Grant, in this article here in theage.com.au that Andrew David is taking over one of those roles that's being vacated. And he's a former Tiger Airways Australia boss and Virgin executive. Well, Virgin Australia I could live with, but Tiger Grant, now that he's working for Qantas, do you reckon he'd answer my complaint from 2008?
Well, I could at least tell you where to go to get the answer.
Yes, well, I'm sure.
Emphasis on the former part of that statement.
It says here that Andrew David was parachuted into the key role of running the day-to-day operations of both Qantas domestic and international businesses in March after a stint at Jetstar. So there's a guy that's going up the corporate ladder very, very quickly, Grant. And speaking of numbers, you mentioned before about Qantas's loss-making international arm, but, you know, I've been reading some interesting commentary just of late over the last few weeks that we've been away that maybe it's on track to make a profit. Have you been reading that in the media?
Yeah, I've seen some of that. I might say,
Grant, didn't you not predict that this is what would happen?
Yeah. Now that they're no longer gutting international to support and bootstrap Jetstar, oh, look, it's starting to make a profit again. Was that me being a cynical bum? Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably.
Yes, absolutely. All right, so let's move on from Qantas now, Grant. I was going to say let's ditch Qantas, but let's talk about something else that was ditched. That's a hell of a segue, Grant. Can you remember what we were doing back, 5 years ago in 2009 when we first started this segment? What were we talking about?
We were talking, among many other topics, about a Pelair Westwind ditching at Norfolk Island.
Exactly right. Grant. Now, you might have thought, dear listener, that that had all been put to bed by now, but no, that's not the case. In fact, looks like the ATSB is going to yet again revisit that investigation.
Well, I'm not surprised, mate. This the safety report produced after this incident has been damned by many people, has been held up as an example of some of the things that are wrong within the Australian aviation world between the ATSB and CASA and so on. And it has left a bit of a smear on the ATSB's normally perfect, fine, upstanding reputation, because there was some information back and forth between CASA that wasn't really reported. They never bothered to pull the data recorders and cockpit voice recorders out of the aircraft, even though it was only sitting in not very deep water and was known exactly where it was, as opposed to all the effort put into the Malaysian 370 when they were looking for that one. So a lot of queries were asked. It was felt that there was a smear campaign against the pilot, all sorts of things going on. And there was even a Senate committee that turned around and released a very scathing assessment of the original investigation, because it didn't really follow the proper process, a fact which has been confirmed by a critical review of the original inquiry by the Transportation Safety Board of Canada.
Interesting that they were brought in to, I guess, audit that that investigation, but yeah, there was all sorts of ramifications for that. And in fact, Independent Senator for South Australia, Nick Xenophon, has been really doggedly following this and from a political level for a very long time, so I'm sure he'll be satisfied that, you know, in one sense, that they're going back and having a look at that. The order to go back and investigated again has in fact come from the Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Infrastructure and Regional Development, Warren Truss. He's asked them to reopen the case, according to this article we see here in australianaviation.com.au. So, Grant, yeah, that's, you know, really an interesting case, and it's more interesting, not so much for what happened, but how the investigation, as you say, was handled. So I guess we'll still be reporting on that all these years later.
Indeed, mate, indeed. But I remember when we reported on the TSB coming in to review the ATSB, and particularly this incident report. And yeah, we were kind of hoping that the findings would help improve the way investigations are done here. And it looks like that may very well have been the case.
Now, Grant, just before we finish up this segment, I wanted to just have a bit of a shout out, I guess. First to our good friend over there across the pond. Well, it's across a lot of ponds from here in Melbourne, Australia, Peter Johnson. Unfortunately, we went on the show last week and Peter sort of signed off for taking a bit of a hiatus for a while. And we just wanted to acknowledge the fantastic work that Peter Johnson has done with that Across the Pond segment for so many years now. He's a great friend of ours. Once again, as is often the case in the new media world, Grant, we actually have never met in person, but we've spent a lot of time talking over Skype and all that sort of stuff. He was a great support to me last year, actually, when I injured myself and had to go through knee surgery and all the rest of it. A great guy, a great friend, and yeah, he needs a bit of a break from it. We understand that, and you know, we hope that things become a little less hectic in his rather hectic work life.
Something we can attest to on our end of the communications link. It's pretty hectic down here. So, mate, we've got a fair idea of maybe what you're going through. So, totally understandable. And we're looking forward to when you come back.
Absolutely. In fact, I've got another thought in a minute, Grant. We'll just, I just want to make one more shout out. And this is actually quite a sad one. We wanted to mention Charlie Wilworth of the Flight Time Radio Show. As we record this this morning, the news came through that Charlie has, in fact, lost his battle with leukemia, which he'd been really bravely fighting for quite a number of years. An absolute gentleman, as I said in a tribute on our Facebook page today. He gave us the privilege of starting our first radio segment along with Milford Shirley, didn't he, Grant?
That's right, mate. We were doing the Flying Down Under segment on their radio show. It was a lot of fun. And the world's a sadder place for the loss of Charlie. He's an amazing guy. And yeah, we've all got great memories of him.
I actually like the comment that, of course, we all, those of you who follow that show would know that Charlie, had been an air traffic controller. And of course, ATC Ben, our own resident air traffic controller here, left a comment there saying clear to leave the control area on climb, frequency change approved. And I thought, what, Charlie would probably appreciate that. So
I think so.
Yeah. So wherever you are now, Charlie, thanks for being such a pioneer in the new media world, particularly in the aviation scheme. I think a lot of us in this game owe him a lot.
Indeed. Indeed. He's probably having fun flying his Piper Cub.
Now, hey, Grant, actually, if I look through this door here, Grant, well, look at all this space!
Isn't this the Across the Pond segment space?
We can have a much longer segment from here. Look, it's not even for rent, we can just squat here.
Wow! It's huge!
Alright, next week, a 1-hour Ausdesk. Judy,
I'll go get the notes ready.
All right. So it's so sad about Charlie. We know that he's really fought this battle for quite a quite a while now. We've all met Charlie, haven't we, at the Udvar-Hazy Center?
Well, if it hadn't been for Charlie, we'd have never been at the Udvar-Hazy Center.
That's true.
That's right. He and Milford invited us to join them several years ago for a Flight Time Radio broadcast live from the center for the Become a Pilot Day. And that's how we got introduced to that event and how we came to participate each year. So we're really going to miss Charlie. Best wishes to his family, also to Milford. It's quite a loss, quite a loss. Okay, now we have Rob's Aviation Minute.
From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark, and this is the Aviation Minute. Producing the Aviation Minute gives me a leg up on the stories I tell you, because of course I know how they're going to end before I even start writing. All I need to do is craft a pitch that's hopefully interesting enough to convince you that I thought it all through. This week, though, I'm not sure how the story ends. I'm not even sure which side of the fence I'm on. Quartz.com ran a story last week about pilots posting cockpit photos to their Instagram accounts. And the photos were just spectacular. Vibrant colors, near-perfect exposures, highlighting incredible scenes of Earth from 35,000 feet. I think that any high school kids who saw them would probably jump at the chance to fly when they realized these could be the scenes out the window of their own office someday. I've included a link to the Quartz story at jetwine.com, too, just in case you missed it. So you're probably wondering, what's newsy about a bunch of egocentric aviators sharing some on-the-job pics? There just happens to be one little problem with the way those photos were captured. For commercial carriers, that's the airlines and the charter companies, the FAA bans small electronic devices from the cockpit, except for iPads that are used as electronic flight bags. That means they also banned camera phones. The regs demand commercial and corporate operators observe what we call the sterile cockpit rule. That means that below 10,000 feet when landing or taking off, pilots aren't supposed to be playing with any electronics not required for the flight. The reason's safety. Most accidents are caused by pilots doing something dumb, so the FAA figures limiting distractions like, well, non-relevant conversations or taking pictures will reduce accidents. And let's be serious. There have been accidents when pilots haven't been paying attention. Of course, the rule wouldn't apply to a light airplane, or if the camera were fixed in the cockpit, or if somebody was in the jump seat shooting the photos. But pilots don't agree with any of this, claiming that taking photos helps them pass the time and reduces boredom. FAA rejected that logic, of course, even when they're cruising at flight level 370. That means that most of these Instagram photos violate the regs and leave the pilots open to a certificate violation at very least, or getting canned at worst. But the pictures are so breathtaking, and they're so useful to show young folks what a day in the life of a pilot really looks like. Let's face it, there is no other way that I know of. So now what? Do we condone pilots violating the regs? No, of course not. But that also means no more spectacular cockpit photos, I guess. I think there's only one real option, since we know that photo posting efforts are only going to go underground from here on. If you're a pilot, you'd better not get caught posting pics that tie you or your company to an impressive shot of your aircraft on approach to O'Hare or anyplace else. But for once, I'm torn. Follow the rules and lose out on chances to share the soul of this industry with others, or assume pilots will think it's a stupid rule and shoot the photos anyway, knowing they're potentially putting their aircraft and passengers at risk. I want to know how you think the industry should respond to this one. Drop me an email with your suggestions at rob@jetwine.com. That's rob@jetwine.com, and I'll let you know about the results in just a couple of weeks. For the Aviation Minute and jetwine.com in Chicago, I'm Rob Mark. See you next time.
Wow, that's a tough one. That's a tough one, Rob.
No, it's not.
You don't think so?
Fire their asses. If the word drone had come up in their conversation, Rob would have a completely different tone.
Well, I actually have a a response to David on that one.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, I had a feeling. I had a feeling.
But no, am I wrong?
David's probably right, and it's it. I don't know. I mean, what do you guys think?
Safety. If you're going to put safety as the number one priority, which you do,
yeah,
then they are putting their passengers and their crewmates in jeopardy.
I know. You're right.
Now everybody and their brother knows that they're not. But the rules are the rules, you know, and the FAA is just going to have to spend the next 6 years coming up with a rule that says you're not allowed to take pictures out of the cockpit of an airplane. Like, I'm sorry, but I listened to this today, Rob, and I went, you need to be consistent. If you're going to take the drone tact about people doing stupid things with an aircraft, taking pictures, no less, then it needs to be an across the board. I know that.
I thought you said that it wasn't really unsafe. Didn't you just say that a minute ago?
I'm not talking about whether everybody in their right mind knows that it's not. For someone who shot hanging out the back of a T-6 Texan today or earlier this year, I know what's safe and what's not safe. But the law is. And the FAA rules are, so the FAA should start citing every one of those people who have an Instagram thing. And unfortunately, we know, and some former guests of ours are people who take those Twitter shots and those Instagram shots.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I wish I could say I disagreed with you. I was hoping somebody would, but I don't know. Maybe some of our listeners do disagree with us. I think I'm almost more interested in hearing how they would formulate their disagreement, because I'm really having trouble with this one, though.
So if you're listening to this, form your opinion or start to form your opinion, and then go look at the photographs, go look at the link, and tell us if that changes your view at all. But David, let me ask you this: if a pilot of a commercial airliner sticks a GoPro to the windscreen on the airplane and just lets it run, is that a problem?
No, that's different. Because, see, that's not distracting the crew. I mean,
you didn't even see my lips move on that answer.
Yeah. So, oh, I'm sorry. Did you ask David that? I'm sorry. Oh, well, okay. But my hearing's gone too, guys. Sorry.
That's all right.
So, I don't know, I thought one of the things that I read on that, and again, David, lips are moving, they needed to maintain a sterile cockpit, and GoPros were not allowed. Maybe I misread that, but I don't know. I'm siding with David on this one. If you don't like the rule, change the law. Until you change the law, it's illegal. You shouldn't be doing it.
And the article mentions that a number of the pilots who took those photos have subsequently taken them down.
Yeah, you're not kidding. They canceled their Instagram account.
Yeah, So Rob, please come back to us, in a week or two time, and let us know how the response has been to your your minute and what kind of reaction you've got. I'm sure our listeners will send some here, and you'll probably get a lot at Jetwine as well. So really,
we'll
curious you to bet. See what people think. All right, next up, we have this is an audio recording that, Brian, you put this together. You want to set this up?
This is the review that I did of the World War II Flying Tigers at the Monterey Park Library.
Now, wouldn't we know that as soon as we hear it? Wouldn't we know that that's what it was?
I don't know. Let's listen.
Libraries are a great and wonderful place that give you a sanctuary to travel the world through the words of others. Be it a novel, work of fiction, nonfiction, biography, autobiography, newspaper, or reference book, they are full of words, wisdom, and thoughts. Libraries are also an underutilized resource in America. The other day, I saw a newspaper article talking about an exhibit that was going on in a local library. It was an exhibit on the Flying Tigers. Now, the Flying Tigers have a special place in my heart, not only because they are a very cool-looking airplane, but because the movie starring John Wayne, Flying Tigers, is the first movie I remember watching with my father, an Air Force veteran. Noting the library was in Monterey Park, a predominantly Chinese community 8 miles east of downtown Los Angeles and 7 miles south of my hometown, Pasadena, California, or in other words, a 30-minute drive from either location without traffic, I decided to check out and pay the library a long overdue visit. Pedro Chen, a Monterey Park resident, has been collecting Flying Tigers memorabilia for quite some time now. He created the exhibit entitled Salute to World War II Flying Tigers in China, which displays 177 prized photos, which are displayed on 48 freestanding trade show-like pop-up displays. The exhibit also includes some artifacts behind two glass display cases, such as an Army Air Force A2 jacket, which to me seemed to be very small, and it made me wonder if it shrank over the years or if the pilot who wore it was very small in size, but not courage. Regardless, the Flying Tigers is the common name for the three official names of the squadron, the American Volunteer Group, China Air Task Force, and the 14th Army Air Force, all under the command of United States Army Lieutenant General Claire Chennault. This campaign was started before our official entry into World War II, and its intent was to defend China against the invading Japanese forces. In early 1941, Chennault and a handful of prominent Chinese officials visited Washington, D.C. to meet with their counterparts from the United States government to discuss what could be done to keep China from falling to the Japanese. Remember, Japan invaded China back in 1939. The plan that evolved from those meetings called for the purchase by the Chinese Defense Supplies Agency of 100 modern fighter planes from the United States. What they got was the P-40 with its famous tiger teeth. To fly the planes, 100 military pilots on active duty from the U.S. Navy, Army Air Corps, and Marine Corps would be allowed to resign their commissions in order to volunteer to fly and fight on behalf of China. Another 200 volunteers from the enlisted ranks would be recruited and hired as ground support personnel, administrative, and medical staff. The Flying Tigers were known for their large volunteer presence and distinguished combat record. In 1996, the United States Air Force awarded the Flying Tiger pilots the Distinguished Flying Cross, and the ground crews received the Bronze Star Medal. These volunteer flyers were paid between $250 and $750 a month, and they were paid bonuses of $500 for every Japanese plane they shot down. Not bad money for the 40s. The Flying Tigers were given credit for destroying 296 enemy aircraft during their service while losing only 14 pilots. One thing I did not know about the Flying Tigers is their ground support units. They had one of the most dangerous jobs of the war. They were supplying the Flying Tigers through the windy, hilly roads of the Burma Highway. The pilots got the credit, but the ground crews got the job done. And the ground crews kept the pilots supplied throughout the war. The Burma Road was a treacherous, unpaved passage hacked through the most rugged mountainous terrain in the world. It stretched for hundreds of miles from northern Burma to Kunming in southern China. From the seaport of Rangoon, supplies were shipped by rail to northern Burma, then transferred to trucks for the perilous journey to Kunming. It was nice to see the exhibit pay tribute to this group of often overlooked and mostly forgotten dedicated individuals. Without these men, the Flying Tigers never would have been able to fly. I was also surprised to learn about all the Chinese pilots who trained in the United States. There were multiple photographs showing all the U.S. air bases. In addition to the training of these pilots, the support the U.S. government gave to China before our official entry into the war is really amazing to me. Although I was disappointed there were only reproductions of photos and no real photographs, the reproductions were great, as well as their accompanying stories. They really gave life to the photographs. It was also great to see how many people were looking at the exhibit, both Chinese and Caucasians. So I suggest to anyone who can, go out and support your local library. And if you're close enough to the Monterey Library, or wherever else this exhibit might be on display, it's definitely worth your time to have a look. And remember, while you're at the library, renew your card. They will appreciate it, and you will help keep a great American treasure open for some time to come. This is Brian Coleman, Associate Producer of the Airplane Geeks, with my review of the exhibit entitled Salute to World War II Flying Tigers in China.
Great,
yeah,
Brian.
Nicely done. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty cool. Go ahead.
I was going to say, based on this, I still would like to second my suggestion from earlier this week. I think Brian needs to be promoted from associate to assistant something, producer.
Something,
don't you?
All right.
Yeah, I Brian, you're in, dude.
Chief bottle washer?
Oh, no. Assistant chief bottle washer.
All right. Hey, let's move on to some listener mail real quickly. We heard from Grant McCarron, who made a couple of points, but one that we can talk about here is on the 787 window shades. I think, was it last week, Brian, last episode? You were yes. kind of critical of the, right, of the dimmable, if you will, 787 window shades. Grant says, I got to play with one when ZA-003 came down under. I thought it might have been a problem with an early version, as it was slow and kind of buggy. But apparently that's how they are. Not impressed with something that gets in the way of the, quote, David Vanderhoof in-flight entertainment system, e.g. looking out of the window. So, interesting. We've got two not complimentary comments. If you've had some experience on the 787 with the window shades, send us an email. I'm curious. Yeah. We're curious to hear your thoughts and see if they support what Brian and Grant have observed. We heard from Chris from Fairbanks, Alaska. He asked if there was any kind of a video, a web video or anything like that, that walks a passenger who has not flown in a long time through current airport procedures to help put them at ease. And somebody, let's see, which one of you guys came up with this video?
That was me.
Okay, this
I was doing my assistant associate producer job.
Well, I did some searching too, and I came up kind of dry, so that's good. You found one. This is from the Canadian Air Transport Security Authority.
Yeah, it was pretty good. I was surprised, actually, at how little there was on this topic, so it'll be great to see if our listeners can do some more searching and see if anything exists.
Great, and we'll put...
Yeah, I was going to say, especially for the older stuff.
Yeah, and we'll put a link to this YouTube video in the show notes. Also, Mike wrote to us, this is an article that he sent along to remember Pearl Harbor, a debate on restoring a last-of-its-kind military plane. And this is concerning the National Air and Space Museum's Sikorsky JRS-1 flying boat. It's the only artifact at the museum that was actually present at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. The question is, do they preserve it or do they restore it? It's kind of an interesting question. I like the fact that the National Air and Space Museum has sort of a mixture of aircraft that are in different kinds of conditions. Some of them look like they just rolled off the assembly floor, and others are obviously in their original condition. So it's an interesting question. I think there are probably arguments on both sides.
It's kind of like that photo argument. okay, maybe it's not like the photo argument. I think it is interesting. I can't imagine how they make that decision about whether they preserve it or restore it. It's too bad David had to run out, but I'm sure that would be a question that he could tell us about next week.
Yes, let's have him do that. Also from Kevin, a link, the flying photographer's haunting images reminds us of Pearl Harbor attack. These are coming up because there was the anniversary recently, the Pearl Harbor anniversary. And this link has some really fantastic images of Pearl Harbor, both historic photographs and modern photographs. And we'll put a link of that in the show notes as well. And then finally, Ray came up with a question, a poser, something to stump us. And he asks us if we could identify the following without doing an internet search, for which airline does or did Captain Tobias Wilcock fly, and for which flight route is he most famous? I didn't know the answer to this. I don't know if don't say it if you did, but did either of you know this answer?
Nope. Even after seeing the answer, I didn't know it.
No.
So.
All right. So if you know, so this is a quiz for the listeners. If you know who Captain Tobias Wilcock is, you can confirm your knowledge to check the show notes at airplanegeeks.com, and we'll put a link in there that will give you the answer. It's kind of fun. All right. Well, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks. You've been listening to episode 329. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. Find the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/329. We want to thank our guest, Bill Herp, CEO of Linear Air. Find out more at linearair.com. And you can learn more about us and our contributors at airplanegeeks.net. Links to all the websites, the blogs, the podcasts, everything that we all are associated with. You can find all that at airplanegeeks.net. And we want to say that opening and closing music is by Brother Love. As always, find him at brotherloverocks.com. Now, we're going to take next week off due to the Christmas holiday. So what we'll ask you to do is to get caught up and then join us again in 2 weeks as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Merry Christmas.
Good night. And Max, maybe for the outtake, because you mentioned episode one, I did actually get the USB drive. So people can now send in the request to my email address, brian@airplanegeeks.com, and I'd be happy to send them a copy of the previous episodes.